Hello and welcome to Building the Game, a documentary podcast. My name is Rob, and with me as always is Jason.
Hey Rob, how's it going?
Very well. We have an extra special guest with us here tonight.
We do.
We sure do. We're thrilled to have him on here. We have Grant Rodiak on the line.
Hey guys, what's up?
We are hanging out here. How are you?
I'm a little sad. I'm drinking water and I just ran and I should have found a more entertaining beverage.
Oh, that's too bad. I'm drinking beer myself. Jason's also drinking water because he's boring too.
I was drinking beer earlier. Yeah. The beer ran out.
You should have kept it up. So yeah, Grant, thanks for hanging out with us tonight. We really appreciate it, man.
My pleasure. Absolutely.
And for our listeners out there, Grant is a game designer. You probably know him best from his game Farmageddon. Can you tell us a little bit about Farmageddon?
Yeah, Farmageddon is a sort of casual card game for 2 to 4 players, plays in about a half an hour. The premise is that you're all farming. The winner of the game is the one who has the most valuable harvest at the end. There's a simple little farming mechanic where you have to plant crops on an available planting field. There's only 3 and everyone fights over them. So you have to plant a crop, you have to play enough fertilizer, which is you flip over the crop cards and play them down as fertilizer so you can either plant them or use them as fertilizer. And then to sort of muck with each other, there's a very strong take that element where you're destroying each other's crops, stealing crops, protecting your crops, and just doing all sorts of mayhem. It's sort of a friendly, aggressive game of farming.
Sounds good. And I haven't had a chance to play it myself personally, and I'm bummed out about that. But Jason, you're a big fan of that, right?
Yeah, I am. Yeah, yeah. I was one of the early adopters. I backed it on Kickstarter, yeah. And then I got
Points
a chance
for you.
We tried to meet up with you at Gen Con. The closest we got was we were sitting about 2 feet from you when you were doing Farmageddon demos, and we were demoing Jungle Ascent, and then I think we're right there. Like I'm pretty sure from his Twitter picture that's Grant. But you were in the heat of the moment doing the demo. And then I want to say by the time we were finished, you were gone or something. So, so we didn't really get a chance to chat.
Yeah. Gen Con, I was demoing Farmageddon from 9 to 6. And then from 8 to midnight, I was testing Empire. So I was always doing something.
Wow. Yeah. And unfortunately, we didn't really get to make it that much to the Unpub area.
I wasn't in the Unpub area. I was actually up the first exposure playtest hall.
Oh, right. Yeah.
How was the experience with that?
I thought it was fantastic. I mean, obviously Unpub is free and I know a lot of the people there, but what I thought was really cool about the thing I did is that I paid, I think it was like $150, and I, for 4 hours every night, had guaranteed enthusiastic testers. I tested, I think I did 12 games in 14 hours, and I think I had 40 different testers. I had some people come back multiple times. I mean, it was really awesome, and I didn't have to organize anything. I didn't have to fetch people. I was literally up there testing the whole time.
That's really good to hear, because I know some of the people we knew ahead of time had kind of balked at the price. But you got, so was it the $150 like flat fee for all the time, or did you have to pay per slot?
It was $150 or whatever the price was. I think it was like $150, but it was $150 flat fee. And I could have had more time. And like next year, I might do that. Like next year, I might say, hey, Phil, I'll be demoing Farmageddon from 9 to whatever, 1 o'clock every day. And I probably could have had more time. I think I remember once I had like figured out my demo schedule, I actually took time away. Like I gave up some of my slots. So I could have had more time.
Wow.
And this was guaranteed testers for every slot. And I could have specified the number of testers. I thought it was really great.
No, that actually sounds really interesting. Yeah. That's probably worthwhile for us to check out.
And the thing that I didn't know before, but I've learned that since then, that when you pay for that, that comes with a GM badge, right?
It does.
Yeah.
I had a demoer badge, which was even better, but it did come with a GM badge. And I mean, Matt Warden was in there, and I can't remember his last name, but Michael, who did from Visible Hand Games,
Michael,
City Hall,
Michael
he was
Keller.
In there as well.
Michael Keller.
Yeah. Yeah. We talked to Matt. We talked to Michael. We actually talked to Phil from Fifth Street Games also.
Yep. Yeah. Phil's a good guy.
Yeah.
He is. So, yeah, no, that's really interesting, because I mean, $150, you get a GM badge. Your GM badge would have cost $75. I mean, assuming you bought a 4-day pass.
Yeah.
So you're really paying $75 for that. That's kind of a steal.
Yeah, that's a good deal.
For guaranteed playtesters.
and they were enthusiastic. Like they showed up in line wanting to play my game. Like I had 2 games running. I did 2 tests at a time, 4 hours every night.
That's awesome. That's awesome. Yeah, that is definitely worth looking.
Definitely gonna have to do that next year. So. Yeah, for sure.
We kind of. I mean, these are people who went in line to get tickets to do that. I mean, just like they would for like a Fantasy Flight demo. So like, it was. I'm gonna do it every year.
Cool.
I do have to say, I do enjoy Gen Con. That is the only place that can charge you to sit to demo your game and then charge people to play it.
Yeah, that always blew my mind. I was like, when people kept talking about tickets being available, I just assumed it was like you just got to sign up for a pass. And right. I'm like, whoa, you're paying to have a dude give you a sales pitch?
Yeah.
Right. You're paying to play a game that's not published that I'm going to try and sell you on. That's genius.
It feels a little dirty.
It does. But it's awesome too, you know. And so that I'm really glad to hear that's a good experience. I will definitely look into that for next year.
Yeah, I think so for sure.
So hey, let's talk about what we've been playing.
Yeah, what you guys been playing?
Well, let me go first since we're already talking about Farmageddon, right?
Yeah.
So Grant, I want to tell you I played Farmageddon with my wife and we both really really enjoyed the game. Yeah, I won't give a description because you gave a better description than I certainly could. One of the things I really want to compliment the game on is, you know, in the first of all, you have the greenhorn tips in there. I think that's what they're called.
I have to give credit to @Winanoid. He gave me the idea for that based on his casual play group.
You know, and that was really nice because, first of all, it's just nice to have some tips because I can see on the outset, if you didn't see those tips, how somebody might be kind of nervous at first when the other player takes all the fields and you're like, I'm never going to get these fields. And it was funny because in the last game my wife and I played, she dominated. I mean, she literally had all three fields 80 to 90% of the time and I lost by 15 points. So then that tells you how balanced the game is, that she was able to do that. And I still, you know what I mean? I was able to keep up pretty good. So I thought that was cool. You know what I mean? That it could feel like she was schooling me, and really, I mean, I know 15 points is somewhat of a spread, but I felt really good about that. I felt like...
Yeah, I mean, in a two-player game, you score quite a bit. I mean, there's sort of the action cards. People just assume, I think, on their first play that the game is purely random. Whoever gets the best action cards wins, and there's sort of a subtle strategy to the which crops you plant, how you draw crop cards, and how many fields you take up. Yep. And typically, the better players will tend to win based on the subtler, you know, the more subtle aspect of that.
And I could certainly see that. There was one point where I had burned all my action cards, and I drew one, and my wife played the, I think it's one with a pig on it, where they can take your card.
Yeah, that's a Farm Futures.
So, that was great. So I get one action card, she takes it, and the action card she took, Farm Futures. So I get my next action card, she took it. Spent a few turns getting schooled by my wife. Now, Rob always jokes because he loses most of the games he plays to his wife.
That's pretty much,
I don't, so I was disheartened. Mm-hmm. But no, it was cool how you could feel like, wow, she's really beaten me on this. And the game is so well balanced that wasn't the case. It was a closer game. So I liked that about the game a lot.
Thanks.
So it was... good time. I'm interested to play it with more than two players. You know, Rob and I both, we seek out a lot of the two-player games or games with two-player options just because we like playing the games with our wives, and we have wives that really like to play the card games, especially in some of the board games. So that's pretty sweet.
Yeah, it actually started out more as a primarily 3- and 4-player game, and I tacked on two-player. And when I released it on a print-and-play site, I was really roasted for the two-player because people... that it felt tacked on and the game didn't really work for it. And over time, one of the biggest things I tried to develop were cards that worked in every player number. And also I had a couple that I just sort of recruited from Board Game Geek, and they played the game for me on and off for like 5-6 months and just gave me tons of great feedback. And they played it exclusively as two players.
Oh, that's awesome.
And it got to the point where I could send them a Geek Mail message, ask them about a tuning change, and he would give me a super thoughtful response. And they're both in the credits for their help. Jim Jamieson and his wife, Nicole, I believe her name is.
That's awesome.
Cool.
It's good to have playtesters like that are that excited about it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was really
good
cool.
Feedback.
Good. Yeah. Well, what about yourself, Grant? What have you been playing?
So the thing that's really stood out lately has been Risk Legacy. My friends are coming over tomorrow night for game 9. We've been playing the campaign sort of mode. That's the only mode, really. But we've been playing that for about 2 months with some regularity, and it's the same 5 of us every time. A lot of people are pretty harsh on Risk, and I don't necessarily want to play it, but I have a fondness for it. It's sort of a game I played a lot as a kid, and it was just really enjoyable, and there's a lot of tension and some good moments.
Yeah, I agree with you on that.
And and I thought that I thought his name is Rob. I can't remember his last name. It's sort of a hard name to pronounce, but he's on Twitter. He did such a good job with Legacy. I mean, just the premise that, you know, you change the game both mechanically as you play. You change the game in permanent aspects on the board. I don't want to spoil things for people, but like. One of the things that's on the back of the box is like you could build cities and you could fortify little areas, and how this plays out over the game, where there's like both a meta strategy to the 15 game spread and the moment to moment, and just he largely fixed all the things that made Risk annoying. You know, there's player elimination is really hard to occur. Games at most I think have taken 2 hours for us so far, and it plays quickly, and it's a really interesting game, and I'm so impressed with it. I just thought it was so. It's really exciting, like just opening the packets and talking about it, and like we've had some holy crap moments when things happen that, like, almost as if you're like watching like a show like Lost or something, and you know, like the cliffhanger occurs. Like we've had really cool moments where we were just like all on edge opening the envelope, and then when it happened, we're like, no way. And to me, that was just really special.
I've known a few other people that have played that, yeah. And they said the exact same thing. And they had said they thought that some of the game, not every package is the same. Some of them have some different envelopes in them and different packets, you know, that you can open.
Yes. I actually spoke to the designer about it. There's one package that's under all of the pieces. They have a really big, nice, inlay, plastic tray. And if you go under that, there's a hidden envelope that says never open. And apparently there's four of those. As for the other ones, I don't know if they have different one of those. And again, I can't really talk about them, but
no. Yeah. And that's one of the things he had a hard time. He was reading a review about it and he had a really hard time not spoiling things for people. He's like, you don't want to know any more about this game. You want to go buy this game and you want to play this game.
Yeah. I got it for $35 on Tanga, and having played it now, I would have paid 50 for it, 75 for it easily. I mean, I just think it's really special. There's something just cool about it that just nothing else has done. Like, is it the best game ever mechanically or any of that stuff? Maybe not, but that the innovation of the permanence and the cards and the surprises and the things we talk about have just made it just a really special thing.
Now, I want to make sure that the listeners who may not have heard of this understand what this is. This is like an add-on for Risk, right?
It's a standalone. So
it is a standalone.
At its core, it's Risk. However, in order to win the game, it's not eliminate everyone. It's gain 4 points, and you get 4 points by either cashing in cards, which are a little bit different from the original game, or by conquering other players' territories. And at the start of the game, you start with the default point if you haven't won a game yet, and so therefore there's a catch-up mechanic so that people can win more quickly early on. And the basic premise is from various conditions, there are envelopes and things that the game ships with. And an envelope might say something like, the first time a player is eliminated, open this. Or the first time two missiles are fired in a battle, open this. And missiles are a way by which you can manipulate dice rolls. You could turn any die roll to a 6. And the really fun part is that even someone not in the battle can do that. So like if I want Rob to lose the battle, I can give Jason a 6 to beat him.
Nice.
Oh, okay. Got it.
That's cool.
So it's really simple things like that. So there's little tweaks and dice manipulations. And over time, you start with factions and like you put stickers on the factions that give you abilities. And a lot of times you have to make a choice. Like it'll be, do you want A or B? And if you pick A, you rip up A and throw it away.
Wow.
So you put like stickers on the board. Like you'll put a sticker on the board that like this is a city and this will always be a city and it does this thing. And I can't talk about a lot of things, but
yeah,
the board evolves, the factions change, and there are new rules and mechanics introduced. So the game starts out as a very brisk Risk, very – that sounded funny – a very quick sort of abbreviated Risk, and it evolves into a game with a lot of mechanics and different things. And then there's the metagame over the course of 15 games. For example, a friend of mine has evolved the country of Australia such that only he can start there. And therefore, we play a certain way to react to him so that we know he's going to have Australia. So we've taken other decisions to keep him from getting those two free units scot-free.
Nice.
And so when you come back to the game and you play it a second time, since you've put these stickers on the board, the game has changed and starts differently the next time?
Yes, in some ways. And they also do things where when new rules are added, there are slots in the rule book for you to add stickers. So it's very easy to go back and catch up on what changed. And in some cases, when you replace rules, you just overlay them onto the old ones. So pretty much every game, we set it up, and I'll just quickly flip through and be like, oh, yeah, this little thing changed. Is everybody cool on that? Yeah, okay, cool. And we get right back into it. And there's a brilliant lesson there also for game design in that the game starts out super simple. I mean, if you've ever played Risk, it's really simple and you don't have to learn much at all. But every game, they introduce new mechanics. And there are new mechanics, like whole new different mechanics that they layer onto it. So had we started with all the stuff that's in Game 9 at Game 1, it would have been like, ugh. But we started at Game 1 and grew into Game 9. And that's also... It's really neat. I just there's nothing like it. It's just, and I'm sort of surprised that more people haven't done it because it's so neat.
Yeah, that man. It's a super clever idea. The idea that the board game can evolve as you play sessions. I mean, it's like an RPG that's a board game. I mean,
that's one of the things I compared it to is that it's sort of like having the world building and the characters and the history of an RPG without all that work.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really interesting. It's a very different approach to game design and to a kind of a board game. Well, I mean a board game traditionally is a game. It always starts the same way, and you play the game and it goes somewhere, but the game ends, and the next time you come back to it, you still start at the same starting point.
Yeah, usually they have a really tight core loop that you just sort of play over and over again. That's replayable and infinite. Yeah,
right.
And people might knock this for replayability, but honestly, if I play 15 times with the same five friends, I've gotten my money's worth. I'm cool.
Yeah,
that's a good point.
Now, how many players do you need to play this?
It plays 3 to 5, and it fully supports, like, if Bob is notoriously late or is a flake, you could play without him, and you just scratch out, like, that faction. You sort of update and keep history on the back. And the factions sort of self-balance over time with different abilities and things like that. We've always played with the five, and we've canceled it if somebody can't make it or whatever, and we'll just play another game. And we've been playing for a couple months now, so we're on game 9.
That's pretty great.
Cool. Yeah. No, it's, and what's so cool about it is the approachability level. Like you said, if you started at game 9, you'd be like, wow. But when you start at game 1 and you've got this really simple version of Risk, that's approachable, you know, and that I like that about it because I know a lot of game players that probably wouldn't want to play a super complicated game, but they would get there by starting at an easy, approachable game and then working up to it, you know, because there are a lot of games out there that have less approachability than I think they could.
Yes.
And people are afraid to give them a chance because, oh, this game looks so confusing. And then you kind of power through it and you realize, oh, the game's not that confusing at all.
Yeah.
You know, but the setup and the reading, you're just like, oh gosh.
Yeah, I mean, I bought Horus Heresy from Fantasy Flight for their Christmas sale, and it's like a $100 game that I got for $20.
Nice.
And right now, it is literally pulsing behind me. It is making a weird high-pitched noise. I'm terrified to open it, and I might never open it because I know, coming from Fantasy Flight, it says 2 hours to 3 hours on the box. It has all these minis and all these cards. I'm probably going to shriek when I open up that box and have to learn those rules.
Yeah. Yeah, I had that same experience with Mansions of Madness from Fantasy Flight. That I would never buy that game on my own because I'm so terrified of it. But I have a friend who bought it, and we sat down to play it. And I mean, they were running the game for us, and it was their third time playing it, and they were still totally lost with all the rules and all the pieces and everything. So, yeah. Yeah,
and that's just not fun. I just think it's really important to focus on accessibility. It's how we grow the hobby, and it's how you create. If you bring a player in, I'd rather players be focusing on strategy and like being awesome at the game, not on how to play the game in the first place. Like, if it takes them 3 times,
right,
just to know the rules, come on.
If it feels like a job, it ceases to be a game.
Yeah.
Like, is there a paycheck for playing this game?
It's funny, we joke about that, but I think I played EVE Online for like a year and a half, and that game is literally work.
I played World of Warcraft for about 2 years online, and I actually finally stopped because I thought that exact same thing. I was like, all right, we raid on Thursdays, which means I got to play on Wednesday, because if I don't get all my stuff together, I'm not going to be ready to raid. And I was like, wait a minute, I'm paying to play this game like every month. This is stupid. So
Where's my benefits?
So I literally stopped cold turkey. Like, it was like, I'm done. Sorry, guys. I can't play anymore.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then they had to go for hiring and job interviews, and they had to bring in new people.
Exactly. Sometimes with a guild, it felt like that.
Oh, yeah.
Right on. Well, I think we should go ahead and move on to our mechanic of the week. And Grant, I think you came ready here with a mechanic to talk about that Jason and I have touched on before, but sounds like you might have a new approach to it.
Yeah, so with my new game design, I refer to it as INNIE because it reminds me of the belly button, and that's funny to me. it's an abbreviation of Insurrection. It's sort of like a Galactic Rebellion type thing. But I'm really drawn to team play. One of the games I really enjoyed a lot this year was 1812 by Academy Games. And that's a game where you have two teams, the sort of British faction and the American faction. But one thing they do that I wanted to try to do differently is that often in that game, for example, it'll be a player's turn and he'll like play his card. He'll have one or two cards that he could play and he'll play the one. And then they all sort of discuss strategy and sort of figure out how they're going to do it and go about it. And because there's no real reason to hide it, what your intentions are from the enemy, because you're going to do it right then. Like, they won't have a way to respond. And I thought, sort of like classic games that like my grandparents and my mom and dad used to play, like Bridge or Euchre.
We're from Michigan. Yeah. We're all about Euchre.
Okay there. Or even like now the beer makes sense. Or like dominoes even. It's just that notion of you're playing with a teammate. The other team is taking a move in between. Like in dominoes, you don't go, I got the deuce tray. Because then they're gonna, around it. So I was trying to think of an interesting way to have team play where you're working together, but you have to sort of know what your teammate wants, know what they're going for. And to do that, you either have to have no table talk, like, which is sort of a weird arbitrary rule if you force it and don't plan around it, or you have to have this like go off in whisper phase like diplomacy, which is why the game takes 8 hours. And so I was trying to think of like how I could bake this into the cards. And so right now I'm thinking of things like, you quickly and quietly sort of agree upon objectives based on the cards that you have. So you sort of agree which ones you're going to do, kind of like, hey, I think we could do three tricks this round. I think we could take three hands this round, and so you sort of know how to play based on what cards you both have. I'm thinking of the idea of sort of a follow mechanic that you see in a lot of games, but in this case, it's like, I, your teammate, I'm going to do this, and if you work with me now, we could do it better or more efficiently than if we just keep working piecemeal. I'm trying to think of ways that you could share cards and information back and forth. Like, one of the ideas I had was an intra-team draft. So let's say me and Bob are playing against you two. Bob and I have 8 cards that we split between us, and you two have 8 cards that you split between us. And we see these cards, but then I'll draft and play one, and then I pass them to you, and you know what card I drew and how I did it and what's left, and so you'll draft a card. And so based on what we both do, we sort of know what we're sort of going for and how we're going to use it. So basically right now I'm really trying to solve that thing of how can we play as a team without talking aloud, and sort of have that mystery and the idea that like two players who really know the game, who know each other and each other's play styles could like really just womp on somebody who is sort of more disconnected. I think that could be really entertaining and fun and build up over time. It sort of has that, that social element that like the Resistant had that you almost don't need to bake in actual design for, because the players will create it for you.
Hmm. So you're talking about an idea here of the rewards people for playing over and over again as a team and really becoming a team. You're talking about encouraging these two players to be a team. It kind of in the way when people play video games, playing cooperative video games team-based capsule flag stuff where paintball or whatever, where people working together as a team, they practice makes perfect kind of an idea.
Maybe. I mean, I don't know if the game will be deep enough to live up to that comment. But if people know the game and are familiar and they have that like, oh, he played that card and we know that this one's already played, well, why don't I do this then? And we can, maybe scare him out into the open or something.
I think what's interesting is, Rob is talking about the idea of, kind of having that team built already and getting used to it. I think there is a market for that, because the game group that I commonly play with, it's a couple of friends. It's a husband and wife, friends of my wife and I, and the four of us get together and we play all sorts of games, and we really like team games, and we're always on the same teams. It's always myself and the guy
Oh, sure.
and the two women play. And you kind of do develop that shorthand. So when we hear about a game like that, it's like, hey, we can, you know, it's built for people like us. That's what it feels like. I mean, we mostly take games like Settlers of Catan and stuff, and we turn those into team games, which is super fun. You know, we play dominoes as well. We play them face up, though, because that makes it even harder because you've got open strategies. Everyone knows what you're doing. So you're trying to work around the players. But like with Catan, and we play it like regular Catan, except you're on a team with a few tweaks. And yeah, you have to develop that shorthand kind of as a team. And knowing your partner and knowing what they want to do and how they like to play makes a huge difference. And what's cool is whenever we pick up a new game, you don't have to relearn that. If you've got your game group, you know how the people play. I mean, even the other team. I mean, I know how my wife plays. I know how the other lady plays, to the point where even with new games, I feel like I can set them up on stuff. You know what I mean?
Nice.
So I think for something like you're talking about, those team mechanics in a new game, you know, as long as they feel familiar, and so many of them do, because I mean, as you were talking about the idea of tricks taking and stuff, I mean, that reminds me of games like Pinochle, even. Where yeah. you're betting on what you can take. Spades, I think, works the same way.
Yeah.
100% mm-hmm. of that. Rob yeah. says yes, so yeah.
I'm sorry, I'm thinking hearts. Excuse me.
Oh, hearts. No, hearts doesn't work
that way. No, it doesn't, yeah.
Spades, I think, is a team game.
Oh, and one of the things that might sort of put this in perspective for you is that I'm taking a lot of the sort of vibe inspiration from those classic, like, trick-taking and you know, team games that, like, our grandparents and stuff play. But it's going to be sort of like a little tactical battle game. You're going to be fighting and, you know, messing with each other and bluffing and moving units around and stuff like that. And I mean, so I'm definitely trying to target that lunchtime or, you know, frequent game group. I'd love to get people to just like whip it up real fast, you know, play through it and be like, oh, they went with that and they did that thing. And then, you know, if it's quick enough, you could play it multiple times to learn, like you said.
Right, right, right. Hmm. Yeah. And I mean, if you develop those groups, like you've got your lunch group that plays it, I mean, they're going to play it multiple times, I'm sure. So that's going to, you know, that actually makes it more fun. Mm-hmm. When you can find a game like that that you can keep playing. Mm-hmm. I mean, there was a while for about 3 years where we played at least 1 to 2 games of Settlers every single Friday with these people.
And it never, my friends are playing Hanabi right now.
And it never gets old. I mean, really, if you've got a game you really love, it never gets old playing yeah. that way.
That's sort of the hope.
Right. Yeah. I mean... Because you can get old, but you want to design that game that's not going to get old.
So, what are some potential downsides of a team themed game, or what are some of the difficult things about approaching game design or a game mechanic or a game with this mechanic? So what are the negatives, or what are the potential problems?
So one of the biggest ones, definitely from a marketability aspect of finding a publisher or finding players, is that it might be one of those games that, like, I'd like to make it work for 2 to 4 players. And does that mean I make literally 3 different games with the different number of players? Or do I just make a really ugly variant for 2? Because you don't want to be like, look, this is only fun for 4 people. Please avoid otherwise.
Yeah.
Right. That, well, I mean, that really... You can, because I want you and your wife to be able to play this and still have a good time.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, and obviously from a marketing standpoint, making a game that's only 4 players or more, you know, it's, you can play this in 4, 6, or 8, but it has to be an even number. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, that's...
That's just not, that's not good.
Right. You know what? It's funny, because I know, I mean, there are certain games that are that way. I mean, I own yeah. games where you don't play them with 2 players, but they certainly do get played less, and they certainly are not the first game I personally would look for. I think another downside to the team aspect is when you do have a fresh group, you know, if you don't have a regular group you play with, you know, you play with different people. Rob, I know, likes to bring games to parties.
Yeah.
And he always brings bad games to parties that no one wants to play. He's like, hey guys, I know you're drunk, but let's play Small World. But you know, so, I brought Civilization. What's going on?
It doesn't work exactly that way.
No, you do bring Formula D though, not looking like a complicated game, has a good deal of strategy to it and a lot of pieces that can be lost by people who are intoxicated.
I look at Formula D as being a kind of a gateway game for people like, oh, I get street racing. Okay, that makes sense. Oh, you mean all 10 people who are at this party can play at the same time? Sign me up. That's why I like to bring Formula D to a party.
Okay. So, but my point is,
yeah.
when you bring game, like if you bring a game that's a heavy team game to a party, and now you're playing with Joe Schmo, who you don't know, and you don't know how he plays, and he might play just like a total moron. That right?
Sure.
That,
yeah. Yeah. I get
that invalidates some of the gameplay.
Yeah.
Because your experience is now solely based on the fact that your partner is terrible at the game and maybe just a terrible human being. But that, you know, that doesn't help. So obviously that's a hurt. But you know, I mean, obviously there are a lot of games that you would not bring to a party. Well, most people would. Rob would, but most people would not. So
most of my friends.
One of my ideas. One of my ideas for that is, in general, I try to approach things like with a real eye for accessibility and simplicity. And like when I play Farmageddon now, I get really mad at things that like I could, you know, streamline or make more accessible. And so, for one thing, is if I can make it accessible enough, make it so learning it is not that hard. It's just that being really good at it is where you want to focus. I think that'll help.
Yep.
And one of the way they're sort of baking in ways to limit a player's options based on what they can currently do, which are some of the ideas I have with the cards of like this needs to be played to this territory or you have to be in this situation to play this. So that's one thing. And the other is, I think if you make it, one of the things I'm sort of going towards is originally I was thinking of a really rigid asymmetric, like both, like one player's the, like the fleet player, for example, and one player's the ground player. And in that case, like you don't want like Bob, who's an idiot, who's like flying the fleet and crashing into the sun. Like, what are you doing, Bob? But so now I'm sort of leaning more towards you could both have elements of both of those things based on the cards you currently have. And so here it's less of a case of, look, Bob completely blew up the fleet. It's not my fault. And more of, you know, maybe Bob misplayed a card that he could have played later or better, but he hopefully won't ruin it.
You know, that's a good point. And that actually makes me think of, because I've seen this with team games too. And if you have less table talk, I think that that helps. But I've seen with team games where one player believes that they are God's gift to that game.
Yeah.
And that every other player is a complete and total moron.
Yeah.
So they're going to tell their partner exactly, like, here's the move you're going to do, Bob. Do this. You know, because that's not fun either. Because that's actually, I don't know who that's less fun for. The guy who's getting told what to do or the other team who's like, this is awkward. Yeah. So
yeah, I mean, if Bob can't talk or non-Bob, mean Bob, whatever Bob we're doing. If mean Bob can't talk. The other guy's on his own to make a decision based on what he knows he can or can't do. And honestly, maybe they'll find a new strategy he hadn't thought of. Like a lot of times players get caught in a rut and if they can't sit there and just play out the same strategy every time, they might find something fresh from it.
Right. That's a good point. So,
yeah.
So I definitely think having the baking it into where you have less table talk is great because you definitely have less of a risk of that happening.
Maybe we should move on to our practicing the pitch segment here.
Yeah, I feel like we're teasing your game a little bit.
Yeah, right. So we might as well have you just kind of tell us what this is, man.
So the premise of Insurrection is that it's a 2-4 player team-oriented game where one team plays as the sort of cruel Confederation coming in to retake a planet that has rebelled. The other players are playing as the sort of stalwart rebellion trying to just have their little slice of the galaxy and break free. Both teams will have access to ground units who are moving about and then also powerful fleet units who can do things like drop orbital troopers down or orbital strikes, ambushes in the asteroid belts, things like that. The game is entirely card driven. There will be no dice or things like that. And through team play, which you just sort of heard about, you'll be sort of building off of each other's ideas and moves to complete objectives, which you guys also agree upon based on your hands that you have. At the beginning of the round, you're sort of going to get a hand and you're going to pass back and forth and be like, I think we should do this based on what I have. But again, this is all going to be sort of quiet, subtle back and forth communication where you need to sort of trust each other and take a risk.
Okay.
I like that so far.
Yeah.
A lot of this is, in some ways, building off some elements from Farmageddon and my other design, which I call Empire, which is sort of dual use of cards. In Farmageddon, it is you can plant it or flip it over as compost,
yes,
fertilizer. And in Empire, you can cash in cards for units, or you can combine cards for powerful battlefield abilities. So in Empire, they had a really simple duality of this or that. And here, I'm trying to capture the same thing of cards have really simple, you know, one or two functions, and you choose which one you want and how to do it within the context of what your teammate's doing and what you guys are trying to accomplish.
Okay.
That's an interesting mechanic. I like the dual purpose. Obviously, for streamlining purposes, that's awesome, right?
Because, yeah,
you know, when components can work as more than one thing, that's always great. But I like the idea of that option that you could use it to do one thing, or you could kind of store them up, I'm assuming, to play them on the field to make the bigger components, to make bigger weapons, right? That's the idea?
Maybe. I'm thinking something along the lines of there may be like a number which could factor into multiple things based on like that'll be sort of like the power of that card. So you could play it for that power, or you could use it for its action, which is more binary and straightforward. And then maybe as I sort of bake through this, there'll be some idea of like, I play this and you're like, oh, sweet, I'll pair it with this and we'll optimize that and ramp it up to something bigger. Or you might want to save that card for another thing you were trying to do elsewhere. So it may be less efficient that you take another turn to do it instead of building off my turn. But at the same time, you get a little more flexibility.
Okay. Can you walk us through a round of the game to kind of give us an idea of how this flows?
Sure. So bear with me as I'm still trying to nail down the first rule set.
Yeah,
one
sure.
of the things I'm really trying to do is simplify it. But at the outset, you're going to both be given some number of cards, probably 5 or 6 cards. You'll each have these cards that are all hopefully very simple. You'll be looking down at the battlefield, which will be a 4x4 grid of, I'm thinking like punchboard cards. Imagine like the cards in Forbidden Island.
Nice. Yeah.
So 4x4 grid, and it'll be the same 16 tiles every time, but they'll be oriented differently. Really quickly, let me lay out how that works. Is those will each have sort of like terrain idea, like this might be a mountain, or this might be the communication center, or this might be a city. And the idea is that I wanted to have flexibility, but I didn't want players to have to learn what they meant or read rules on the cards. So the way I'll feed into that is you might have a card that you can only play to the communication center, or that you require to play on a plains, or it can't be played in the mountains. And that way I can sort of thematically provide variation based on the terrain without forcing you to learn that, oh, mountains mean this and cities mean that.
That's a great idea. Yeah.
So, and that's one of the things I was talking about of like baking it into the cards without having to learn a lot. So, you've got this terrain and you sort of see your position of where you are and whatnot. Another thing I should explain is that you'll have units on the ground. And what you could do will be where you are currently on a card with your units, or adjacent, orthogonally. So up, down, left, right, not diagonal. The fleet will also be in a position, and the fleet is adjacent to the 4 cards on the side of the grid, as well as the 2 cards that face it in the center. The notion is that you're orbiting the planet, and that's how I've created an orbit out of a 4x4 grid.
Nice.
So you'll have cards that affect the fleet and your ground units, and you can drop more ground units and things like that. You're an invasion fleet, or you're a local army that's risen up. So you both have your hands of 6 cards, and your opponents each have 2 players with 6 cards. And then I believe you're going to draw like a set of objective cards. These are probably going to be like simple little things that you think you can pull off. And you're both going to look at those, and you're going to look at your own private hand of cards. And I'm thinking somehow if you're going to basically say like I pick these 3 and pass them across. I think we can do these 3. And you're going to be like, I'm looking at what I have. I don't think so. I think we can do 2. I think we can do 2 of these. And the game is basically going to be won by who can both pull off the most objectives, which at the end of the game will give you points or be worth something. And mid-game, I'm believing they'll do something like, if you do this objective, it gives you this output. Maybe it's more units. Maybe it's higher morale. Maybe you capture the communication center as a result, and it does this thing for you. Again, I'm trying to figure that out. And the idea being that you might take more risk, hoping that your opponent has what you or your teammate has what you think you have, in order to get the output of it. However, if you expand if you reach too far, you might be set back a little bit. So now that we've agreed upon what we think we can do, and we discard the other ones, we're going to do card play sequential, where player one will play a card, do its action. You know, might be moving units around, might be attacking, might do an orbital bombardment, something along those lines. Then the player to my left, who's an opponent, will play a card. And let's say his teammate sitting across from him is like, oh yeah, I'm going to pair up with that and we're going to optimize this action. So now they do a really powerful one. Then my teammate sitting across from me takes his turn. And then the opponent next to him takes a turn. And we just keep going like that until we play X cards in a round, discard the rest, and then we do another round.
All right. So
sorry, that's a lot.
No. I mean, that's perfect. I'm just processing that. The I mean, really, the for as much information as you just pushed out there, the, I mean, that's actually pretty simplistic in how it would play.
Yeah.
In the order. That's. I was trying to think about. So the idea that, you know, you're laying down these objectives, and then you're kind of agreeing upon how many you think you can do. I really like that.
That's great.
You know, I'm one of those people that, and we've talked about this before, I love thinking of mechanics to incorporate it into board and card games that are not necessarily born of board and card games, you know, more like, say, video game-esque. That's sure. always been like, I love the idea of building games. Like, I love the games like where you're building a city or something like that. You know, not like SimCity, but those types of games.
Yeah.
And the idea of the objectives, I think, really falls in line with that, right? Because that's pretty video game driven when you've got, you know, all right, do this. Now your next objective is do this. And when you do this, you're going to get these rewards. And I think that's really cool to have that in a card game like that, especially when you're basically using it as a trick taking type of thing. Because that's right. That's the mechanic is meeting those objectives is like taking those tricks. Because at the end of the game, it's going to help you.
It's not a trick mechanic, but that's the inspiration is we're working towards that thing, which may be having units here or winning this battle or something. It's almost like an achievement that if we can pull off, it'll direct our play for that round. But it has also like meta, you know, spanning round implications.
And, you know, that's an even better way to put it, an achievement. Because with an achievement, it's just like every game you've played to where, you know, now on every phone game you have on the iOS or whatever, the Game Center, you get the achievement for doing this or that. So the idea that actually unlocks new things for you in the game and gives you bonuses and stuff, and that also helps you win the game, that's awesome. I really like that.
And I'm hoping for that moment where, like, let's say I'm playing with you, and I'm like, I think we could do four, and you're like, dude, and you're looking at your hand, and you've got just, like, total crap. And you're like, no, I think we could do like maybe two. And you're like, no, dude, trust me. We got four. We could do this. And like, I would love to have that moment where you're like, all right, you better, like, can't we do three? And you're like, no, four. Trust me. I think, and then all of a sudden the other, you know, our opponents are looking across. They're like, shit, they're doing four? Should we do three? Like, I don't know, dude, my cards are terrible. I would love to have that tension, that like eagerness. Cause like me in a game, I'm typically really aggressive. I like to charge head first. It's why I lose a lot. and I could see where this thing, like, Grant, I swear to God, if you like, and like, dude, why you picked four on that hand? Seriously? I think that's a richness that, it's less about the game and more about who you're playing with. Like, obviously, if you're playing with Jerkwad McGee, it'll be like, that was not the optimal playing. But, you know, if you're playing with your friends and you're having a beer, I think that's a moment almost like, you know, my dad goes and plays dominoes at the golf club. Like, that's sort of the that sort of old school element that appeals to me, that vibe, that moment.
Right.
Yeah. That's something you don't frankly, you don't hear a whole lot from board games and card games. You don't hear that kind of team banter, that kind of, you know, dude, right. Go with it.
That you get with, I mean, that conversation you just had sounded a lot to me like every game of Euchre I've played with good friends. So, which is awesome to capture that, because that, again, is something, well, it is a card game mechanic. It's not our type of card game mechanic, you know? So to be able to pull that mechanic in and make it work, it's awesome because it does feel familiar. And
I pull that experience in. Yeah.
I mean, it's more of the experience than the mechanic. Yeah. And it really, it makes, I think, for somebody who's maybe not used to playing games like that, it makes it feel familiar to them when they start to play.
Yeah.
You know, assuming they get past, you know, it's about galactic stuff. Because, you know, that's an issue I sometimes run into with some of the game people we play with. It's like, oh, this game's about superheroes? That's stupid. Let's play a game about settling in the Mediterranean or something. So.
I haven't typically done the space theme just because it's so overdone, and like for like female gamers, like, and I don't want to paint like a broad brush here, but like, you know, like my girlfriend would not be interested in a space game. And you know, space is typically like your Warhammer 40K like dude fest.
Yeah.
And you know, so right now it's a space theme because I'm thinking of like the orbital troopers and dropping those guys in and things like that, but Honestly, I could probably fix it around, and as I design it, I may find that it has a better home somewhere else. You know, something more interesting. One other little thing I wanted to talk about that I think is kind of neat, that'll be kind of fun, is I really like Stratego. I think Stratego is awesome. Like, Stratego is one of those old school games that I still want to play. Like, it's more than just nostalgia. I actually want to play it. And, right. And I love the bluffing and the planning around your bluff. So right now, the way my units work is that you have two types of chips. You have blank chips and you have like ones. And think of like a set of poker chips that have a number on the bottom. So there's zeros and ones. And when you place your units, you have... you might place, like, let's say you put five chips down, you might place three ones and two zeros. So your opponent knows that you might have five guys, but do you have three or four or one?
Right.
And so there's the bluffing of moving around really simple chips. That was something I liked about Empires, that instead of having like horses and cannons and different unit types and things like that, you basically just have cubes. And cubes are sort of an abstraction of leadership, morale, unit numbers, fighting effectiveness. And so that's sort of what I'm doing here again, which is you have a set of units. They're worth a certain value in battle and whatnot. But now some of them may be an outright lie.
Hmm.
I like that.
Yeah, that's cool.
You know, that's a good way to be able to, you know, bluff and approach that to screw over your opponent.
Yeah.
Which is, if you, when you reveal that and you're like, are you serious? I spent three cards bombing you and you had a dude. you know, those are fun moments. And if you could draw them out, and then you have that thing of like, ah, what is he doing here? What is he doing here?
Yeah.
That tension just drives people nuts, and it's really sticky and fun.
It does. Yeah. Yeah. No, that's, and that helps, you know, if you've got a player that's good at bluffing.
Yeah. Right.
They're going to do well with that. And if you've got a player that's not, I mean, it's not necessarily going to handicap them, because it's not like you have to give them the poker stare or they need to wear sunglasses or something. You know?
Yeah. I mean, my favorite memory of Eclipse, which I've played a few times, and I think it's a really great game, is this one game. My friend and I had this massive border with each other, and we both had huge fleets. And at the beginning of every round, he would look at me in the face and say, are we cool? And I'd say, oh, we're cool, dude. And we just stared at each other the whole game. And and at the end of the game, still now, he's like, oh, I should have attacked you. And he never did. and it just completely. And so we didn't have a battle, but that social tension that we created based on what could have happened was far better than the battle that could have emerged in the first place. That's what I remember.
Oh, that's great.
Cool.
And I want to be clear, too. I wasn't bashing the galactic theme. I was just saying.
No. But I think it's worth bashing. I mean, it's like, I'm pretty proud of Farmageddon because there's a lot of farming games, but it's sort of a silly twist on farming. And I think the cards kind of make people laugh. And like, if you look at like Agricola, brilliant game, top five or whatever, I don't want, like, that's not where I'm going at. But like, it's like, yes, you're here farming and hopefully your family doesn't die. well, and, you know, I like the silly, unique themes.
Right. In Farmageddon, I mean, when you look at Farmageddon's box, you think, how could that not be fun? Those vegetables look so happy.
Yeah.
And so ready to do stuff. And there's a tornado coming, you know, so.
Yeah Sluggo doesn't know any better. Poor Sluggo.
Yeah, I mean, like, I'm so happy. I'm cool.
Yeah, and I mean, if I Empire, my little war game is currently sort of like a kind of a 19th century Risk-esque setting. But like, if I got to direct the art for that, it would be, you know, really elaborate, big pickle halva, pointy helmets and epaulets and mustaches and huge swords and cavalry charges. And it would almost be like what a 10-year-old thinks that Napoleon was.
Nice.
And to me, again, that's just, it's more fun and it's a twist. I think we do ourselves and our market a disservice by, like, look, space is dark and dreary and it's so fun every time. And it's like, we need to find ways to add twists to existing themes, because there's comfort there, but I think we could do new fun stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, I know what you mean. I actually have a game that I'm going to be pitching in the near future that's kind of set in a cyberpunk future, and it's about computer hacking. And I just kind of, I keep stopping myself and thinking, oh man, cyberpunk, really?
And I thought, sure? It was, when you told me about the idea, I thought, wow, did Rob just pitch a cyberpunk game to me? Because that just seems not up Rob's alley.
Oh, yeah. But yeah, I mean, it seems to fit the idea, but I really kind of feel like I want to come up with a different theme for it. You
and,
know?
And in your case, Grant, with the idea of the orbiting mechanic, you know, that comes into play. That's really awesome. Like, that's worth having the space theme just for that, if that really works well in the game, you know?
Yeah, that's a huge, like, that was inspired by like Heinlein's, you know, mobile infantry from Starship Troopers.
For sure.
You know, orbital drop shock troopers from Halo universe. You know, the dudes in the new Star Trek where Kirk and that dude jump out of the thing and sort of pile it down. Like, the idea of paratroopers in the future is just awesome. Right. Exo Squad was one of my favorite cartoons growing up. I could probably still watch it. And they had these, like, drop troops that would just, like, shoot out of these canisters. And just the idea of a dude, not only, like, paratroopers are kind of amazing still. We just don't use them because the war doesn't work like that anymore. But, right. like, the idea of you're, like, sitting there farming and all of a sudden, like, literally a dude drops from outer space. You're like, that's, you know, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Until he shoots you. And then it's not awesome anymore.
That minor problem.
But no, so... It's, you know, it's tough. Sometimes Rob and I have wrestled with that too, where we feel like, you know, do we want to tack on a different theme to this? Because this theme is more marketable than that theme, but then it does kind of a disservice to the mechanics because the mechanics work really well, you know, and you don't want to have a game and you're like, oh, I'm not going to do it about space. I'm going to do it about, and then just pick something random and then try and make the mechanics match that, you know, that, because I think, you know, anytime you have a game where the theme is just plastered on, you can tell.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's probably ultimately safer to basically, look, pick the theme that it's actually right for. Like, if mine's inspired by Orbital Drop, Shock Trooper dudes, then I should probably pick a space thing. But, like, how can I make space special? How can I do space different than 40K, than, you know, Twilight Imperium, than Eclipse? I mean, those are fairly straightforward sci-fi things. So how can I make it different and make it my own? And is this a matter simply of art style or, you know, flavor text? Like, how can I do that? And I think customers appreciate that. And I don't think you have to go too far. I think they'll meet you halfway.
Yeah, no, yeah. I agree. And, you know, art style makes a huge difference.
Yeah.
Maybe just take all the characters from Farmageddon and put them in the outfits.
Corn in space! We're popping kernels.
Don't get too close to the sun, because, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I think the message here, you need to be true to the game.
Yeah, I definitely think so. Yeah.
You got to be true and honest to the idea, to what works about it, and if it ends up being another zombie game, well, you better hope it's a really good one.
I mean, let's face it.
He's looking at me when he said that.
Yeah. If need be, I'll have steampunk paratroopers drop down into a zombie-infested Cthulhu world.
As long as you also include anime chicks in skimpy clothing, that Kickstarter will make $10 million.
Yeah.
As long as they're miniatures.
Right. Yeah. Yes.
God, I'm so sick of the naked chick stuff. I mean, we could do better.
Yeah.
Rob and I have talked about that, how, like, if you want a game to make a bunch of money, make some skimpy anime chicks and throw in some zombies and miniatures, and you guaranteed are going to make a bundle of money,
yep.
even if it's junk. And I'm not naming any names about games out there that are junk because I haven't backed any of them, but... It doesn't matter.
It's interesting. I've actually seen a couple zombie games fail now. And I think, honestly, like, the market at some point gets smarter. Like, I kind of want to make a zombie game because, like, I'm not really a big zombie guy, but it might be kind of fun to sort of tackle that, although it's been so tackled by so many people that I probably should just look elsewhere. But, I mean, hopefully the market at some point wise up that, like, look, good games, whether it's a good zombie game or a good castle building game, like, should be rewarded, but people who just tack crap out there should not be rewarded with customers.
Well, the first game I pitched ever on our show was a zombie game, mm-hmm. and I still really love the game because I feel like it's different than the zombie games I've played, and I feel like it would be more fun. It would be more comic artwork and stuff like that, but, you know, it bothers me because I just think, gosh, it's just another zombie game that's out there. Mm-hmm. What's going to make someone look at it and say, that's the zombie game I want to try? You know?
Yeah, it's really hard to get off the shelf with that. Yeah. I mean, there's just a lot of them, and how are you going to compete? Like, a zombie side says, like, 50 minis on it, and you're like, oh, I can't beat that.
Right.
Yeah. Right.
I think I like when people come up with new twists on a theme, like you know, Ben Rossett, right?
Yeah.
With Mars Needs Mechanic. I mean, like, it's like, hey, let's make something kind of steampunky, and let's put it in, you know, like, let's have them go to Mars.
Yeah, but it's not, like, really even about the steampunk theme. It's, yeah.
Right, but
yeah.
It's still, you know what I mean? It's still...
Yeah, it's different.
It's
yeah.
a twist on right. what you would expect.
Right, right.
And yeah, that's it's cool. comfortable and yet it's new. Yeah. I met Ben at Gen Con. I actually got to play the demo with him. It was really cool.
Yeah, Rob got to as well. I wasn't able to, but Rob got to.
Yeah, I liked it a lot.
Accidentally, so.
Shame on you.
I know.
Deepest of shames.
I felt bad about it because that, you know, that was one of those games at Gen Con where a lot of people were talking about it.
Yeah.
So.
It had a really simple mechanic that was really clever. And like Ben likes to say this, but people, it sort of clicks for him midway through. And We all thought it was really slick. I got to play with Cyrus Kirby and his brother, and then Ben sort of watched and helped guide us through it. And it was impressively simple. Like, I really admire people who do that, because like, that's what I'm trying to do, is have more elegance, more simplicity in my designs that makes people feel clever and gives them a rich experience.
Yeah. Yep, for sure.
Excellent.
I think we should probably wrap up here tonight. Yeah. Sorry, man. I think we want to make sure we give you a chance to plug what you got, Grant.
Sure. So I write about games, and I try to feature guest writers on my site, hyperbolegames.com. Just one thing without spices, hyperbolegames.com. My game, Farmageddon, is available on my publisher site, FifthStreetGames.com, or Amazon, Funnigan, Cool Stuff, and it's $15 and often less. Great stocking stuffer game. And I have a print and play for my game that's currently being shopped to publishers. It's called Empire of York, and you can find that on my site as well. And yeah, I'm on Twitter if people ever want to hang out, at HeroGrant, H-E-R-R-O-H, Grant. So yeah, I try to participate in the community and hang out with folks. So yeah, come chat.
Sounds good.
Sounds good. Yeah. And I just want to give an extra plug for Farmageddon. Definitely. Yeah. You guys should buy it, cause it's a lot of fun and I really enjoyed it. So
I appreciate that.
Yeah, no, it's one of those games that I saw on Kickstarter and was like, I have to back this. Even if I didn't, well, I just have to, it just looks like so much fun. And it was, which is cool, because, you know, nothing worse than backing games, yeah, finding out that it wasn't fun.
Oh, it's garbage.
Cool.
I want to give one quick shout-out, yeah, to the Unpub Network again. Yep. They're having their Unpub, yeah, Event 3 coming up. We love those guys. As I've said before on the show, if it was not for them, my game would not have gotten bought by a publisher when it did. So we love them. Go to their website, unpub.net, and check out their stuff. Grant, I'm sure you're familiar with them, so...
Yeah. John's a good guy. Daryl's a good guy. They're good people. I'm on the West Coast, so I haven't had a chance to take advantage of it. But they're good people, and it's a really good resource.
Yeah, and
they actually have my game up on there. They have my PNP on their site right now, actually.
Oh, that's cool. Awesome. Cool. Okay. So check that out while you're there.
Yeah. Absolutely. All right. Well, hey, thank you everybody for listening to Building the Game. We really, really appreciate it. You can check out our website, which is buildingthegamepodcast.com. You can send us an email to buildingthegamepodcast@gmail.com. You can follow us on Twitter @podcastbtg. Jason is @JASlingerland. I am @poorly_designed. You can like us on Facebook, and you can leave us a 5-star review on iTunes if you like. We'd like that, you know. Hey, it'd be awesome. You can keep on checking in with us here every week and keep on listening to the show. And did I miss anything?
I don't think so. Just thanks again, Grant.
Thank you a million times, Grant.
It was my pleasure.
We would love to have you back sometime in the future.
Yes, most definitely.
Anytime. Hopefully to talk about something published.
Absolutely.
All right.
All right. All right. Thanks again, everybody. Good night.
Good night.
Building the Game is a co-production of Imminent Entertainment and Poorly Designed Studios.
All the ideas presented by Rob and Jason are the property of the Building the Game podcast.
Next time on Building the Game.
We're in Kalamazoo, so we're in Southwest Michigan.
But
you guys on the West Coast, it's like all the same place, right?
Yeah, what a week.
This is the Midwest. There's like a
people
lake in the middle.
Speak English or whatever. uncivilized people, they don't even know.
They were just like, hey, what's up, eh?
Yeah. Let me fire my shotgun.
There is some of
that.
I grew
up in Texas, actually. So.
Oh gosh, yeah, you can't talk.